B-Pod Studios.
Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, the guy using your member number at the snack bar, Charlie Nance.
Hey there, welcome back. Once again, we're Taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at CLT underscore golf guy. And you know what? For supposed downtime on the PGA Tour, we are sure loaded with a lot of intrigue. We got players suspended for doctor-prescribed marijuana, Tiger writing a memoir, competing in Japan, not to mention making upcoming President's Cup picks. We'll discuss these topics and more with Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, and with John Patrick, syndicated host of the Augusta Golf Show. Also, we'll check in with Peter DeYoung, the driving force behind the Winter National Junior Series at Pinehurst, one of the finest junior tours ever. Anywhere, set to kick off its 26th season next month. So without further ado, let's tee it off with Ron Green Jr. Ron, I want to ask you about the Matt Every situation. This is puzzling to me in that it seems to be another case of the PGA Tour with their selective transparency. They have no problem mowing over the little guy, it seems. And not only that, but it's a drug suspension with a prescription from his doctor in Florida. It seems to me someone's going out of their way here to do the wrong thing.
I don't know if I'd say that. I think they have rules. And, you know, in terms of making it public, the only suspensions and penalties they make public are, when you violate the drug policy. They made that clear from several years ago when they adopted this. And the Matt Every case, you know, Robert Garrigus had something relatively similar, both of whom were prescribed substances that didn't fit under the protocol of the PGA Tour, and hence thus they got the positive test and the suspension. It's a difficult thing. I think in this statement, Matt Every said, I understand why this is happening because I understand this is against the rules, but yet I'm doing something my doctor prescribed for me. I'm sure in other sports it's the same way. There are things like, okay, you can do this, but, you know, you're going to test positive and you're going to face the penalty. I think if you know the rules, you got to abide by them. I mean, you could listen to what Rory McIlroy said this week. I mean, he said he's almost afraid to even take an ibuprofen just because he doesn't want to risk a positive test for anything. Jordan Spieth was talking about antihistamines and saying, you know, I don't have serious allergy problems, but I understand other guys do. And you could innocently flunk a drug test because you took the wrong sort of allergy medicine. So, I think the rules are there for a reason, and I think it's important for the tour to, you know, if those are our rules, we've got to abide by them. We've got to enforce them. Now, you can argue whether those are the right rules or not, you know, the right substances or not. I'm no chemist or scientist. I know they're playing fast and loose with the CBD thing out there right now, and I know a lot of players don't want to touch it because they're afraid of what could happen down the line. But I think that's an area I'm sure being considered and looked into, deeply right now. But, you know, I think while I appreciate the situation Matt Every finds himself in with his, you know, with what the doctor prescribed, I think he also knew these are the rules, and, you know, here's what happens if you test positive.
I get that it's the rules. I also maintain that this is a sort of situation where you can't be black and white. I just think so many rules now, we try to think of things as black or white, and there's just increasingly deeper shades of gray in all of these areas, especially this. And I think that's what kind of is a head scratcher to me, is when I start to see things like, you know, doctor prescribed. Well, if a physician prescribes it, then doesn't the tour have to take that into account? I don't know. Maybe it's just me.
Well, and I should know the details, but I don't. I think something similar may have happened with Scott Stallings a while back, you know, that it was intended to be, you know, to help him, whatever it was he was found guilty with or to have violated the policy with. And, you know, I think, but he had to pay the penalty for it. I think that's something that I'm sure in their PAC meetings and other things, they will discuss that. What do we do with this? But I think they, as I understand it, they're pretty much, they follow the World Anti-Doping Association guidelines, and this is what, you know, how the rules are written, and I think, you know, that's the way they want it to be. I think, you know, there have been discussions about beta blockers and all sorts of other things and gray areas there, but I think if you have a policy, I don't think they have, especially something like this, I don't think they have the room to have selective discipline there. I think, you know, and I think that was part of what Vijay Singh, my sense of, was Vijay Singh challenged them on that when he was in his whole deer antler spray suit with the tour. Now, obviously, we're never going to get the details because they settled that and agreed not to talk about it. But I think that's part of what was behind his willingness to take them to court. So I would think now that if, you know, I'm just taking, you know, trying to piece A, B, and C together and see where it leads us, I think, all right, we can't afford not to just do exactly what we said we were going to do.
Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest taking Dead Aim. The tour is in Japan this week. The week kicked off with the Skins game, or a Skins game, rather. Ron, it reminded me of how much that I miss the Skins game. It used to be a Thanksgiving tradition. It was a silly season event. But one thing that did strike me, and maybe my memory has just softened on the event, I seem to remember professional golfers taking more pride in what their game was going to look like when they put it on public display. The first half of that Skins game had some of the worst shots I've ever seen professional golfers make. You have 170-yard par threes, and three out of four of them put it in the water, almost chunk the tee shot, and the other horks it left over a bunker. You had badly pulled shots, bad hooks. It was ugly golf.
I'll take your word for how ugly it was, because I watched part of one hole and found the whole thing to be underwhelming. You know, I think I kind of wonder if those things haven't outlived their usefulness. You know, I'm with you. I remember Thanksgiving weekend, you get nine holes on Saturday, nine holes on Sunday, or however it was, and watching those guys, and, you know, the stakes just seemed astronomical. And here we are today, where when they're playing for $350,000, which is a whole heck of a lot of money in reality, and we're thinking, well, they're not even playing for anything. Well, that might say more about us than anything, but I just couldn't generate any enthusiasm or interest in it. I you know, like I said, I watched the first hole, saw Tiger sort of beating it around there, and the other guys, you know, I like the fact that they were going for the relaxed vibe for it, but it seemed like, yeah, it was almost like, okay, we're just out here, almost like a practice round, and playing a little Skins in practice, and I don't know. I think, you know, I was underwhelmed by the Tiger Phil thing last year, and I think, you know, maybe because we have so much access to these guys now, we can see them Thursday through Sunday, virtually every week. We can see the European Tour. We see there's so much golf available to us, and every time the big guys play, which we'd all like to see them play together more than we do, we get to see it. And I just, I don't know, it just didn't do it for me this time.
Ron, as we're recording this conversation, round one of the Zozo tournament in Japan has taken place, and out of nowhere, Tiger Woods bogeys the first three holes and then birdies nine of his last 15 to shoot six under par and take the lead, which leads us to this next conversation, and that is about the President's Cup. Captain Tiger Woods has to make his captain's picks at the end of this week. I've been on the fence each way in the last 2 weeks as far as what I thought he would do and what I think he should do. So I'm going to ask you, what do you think Tiger is going to do, and what do you think Tiger should do?
Well, if you look at this, what if he weren't the captain? Would he be one of the four players picked? No doubt, I think. So I think he wants to play. Well, he said as much. I mean, he said as much as in his pre-Skins game press conference when talking about his knee surgery and what it did for him and the time off and how it affected him last year. And he said, now I feel like I can finally get back and play. And he goes, I want to play well this week. I want to play hero, and I want to play in Australia. So, in effect, he said it. Whether he does it, you know, he's got four spots. Who knows? He might have five, depending on the severity of Brooks Koepka's knee situation, which, you know, when Tiger said he told Brooks to take his time, and he said, I know he's getting a number of different opinions before he decides which path he will choose for fixing things up, which makes you think maybe it's more serious than we thought. You know, who knows if at this point if he's going to be ready for playing in Austria, which suddenly would give you a fifth spot. I think Tiger's going to be on the team as a player. I don't think there's a wrong answer, really, for him. I think he's in a good spot because I think he just showed us with this round that, you know, he can, you know, he's obviously still Tiger. I think the balance, the decision he has to make is how much he wants to be there on the first tee with every match, every day, including on Sunday when all the singles go out there. And can he, you know, sacrifice a little bit of that to play? And, you know, I'm sure Zach and Steve Stricker and Freddie, his vice captains, are going to say, hey, yeah, you should be one of the four guys. And I think the eight guys on the team are going to lobby for him, too. It's his decision. I'm leaning toward him saying yes. I don't know. Maybe a week ago I was leaning toward him saying no, but I don't know. I think he, you know, I just think he wants to be part of it in every way. But again, I don't think either answer will be wrong.
Ron, other Tiger news in the last week or so was an announcement from the man himself that he was penning a memoir, or probably has a ghostwriter doing it, described it as his definitive story. Kind of a head-scratcher to me. I don't expect a tell-all from Tiger Woods, and I really thought the book that Armin Katayan and his partner did was fantastic and really well-researched and gave me everything I ever wanted to know and even some I didn't want to know. Why is Tiger doing this? What is the end game? Because he always has one.
Well, I think he's doing it because he wants to tell his side of it, and I think the book you referenced that came out last year was a driving force behind it. I think he thought that was so egregiously wrong, and I've seen the multiple page list of mistakes in that book that really infuriated him, and things that they just insist were blatantly wrong, and they ignored when I think they were confronted about it. So I think that's when he talks about stories, books and stuff being written about him. I think that, you know, that had falsely portrayed things in his mind. I think that was part of it. I think, you know, there are two more books coming out of him right now. Kurt Sampson has done one and Michael Bamberger is doing one. And there's an HBO production coming out about Tiger too, none of which he has cooperated with. So it, you know, leads you to believe that, you know, there's, you know, not saying they're not going to be totally accurate, but they're not his voice. And this gives him his voice. I know we're not going to see the book for a while. It's not like the publication is imminent.
Right.
I would think we're many months, if not a year or two down the road before this comes along. And I think, you know, he's going to talk to he, as I understand it, he will write it in his voice, but he will, all the inner circle from caddies, agents, friends, family, all that stuff will be incorporated through his voice. So anyway, I just think he's frustrated by all the things that are out there. And he's, you know, never like just sat down and detailed, hey, this is wrong, and let me tell you how it's wrong. I don't expect a full tell-all. I don't think we're going to go he's going to go tabloid and, you know, here's what happened on the night and all this. I'm sure there's probably some non-disclosure agreements with that anyway. But I think it could be fascinating if he really will open up and tell us a lot of, give us anecdotes, show us and tell us what it was like in different parts of his career and different parts of his life. On the golf course, around the golf course, and away from the golf course, because I think, you know, we see Tiger the golfer, but that's about all we see and about all we know him. He doesn't give us many glimpses. Now, I've been fortunate where he's shown me pictures of the kids or told stories about them doing this or them doing that, but that's not something he's sort of shared with the public. And I think, yeah, as deep as he will go and as much as he'll tell us, the better it will be. You know, I'm like anybody else. I'll be curious as to how the book comes off and how deep it goes. But I just think he's tired of other people. We've always known that he's never liked other people profiting off his name when he's not involved in it. And I think this is his chance to sort of, all right, I'm going to clear the air and here's my story and let's leave it at that.
Get you out of here on this. Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest taking dead aim. October 25th, 1999, a huge loss to the world of golf and to the world in general. I had Kevin Robbins on last week talking about his book that he's written about Payne Stewart, and it's a fantastic read. You covered Payne. You were around Payne Stewart. As you look back 20 years later, and first off, I can't believe it's been 20 years, but as you think back 20 years, what are the things that stand out in your memory of being around Payne?
20 years. It's been fast, hasn't it? I sort of go back to that moment standing out there beside the 18th green at Pinehurst number 2 on that drizzly gray Sunday in 1999, one of the great Sundays in U.S. Open history, and being there when he made that putt and all that came with it. I mean, the last hour or so of that championship was just, felt sort of like the big climactic fight scene at the end of a Rocky movie, with the punches being thrown back and forth by all these guys. And, Payne Stewart kept holding putts and doing all that. And just when you think he's about to kick it away, he makes that par, the 72nd hole, and the statue and talking to Phil and all that. I mean, those things come to mind. I can remember standing there and how quiet it got, because I remember thinking I could hear a bird in the distance there, but that was all I could hear. And those few seconds before he made the putt, and the noise exploded like something over at Fort Bragg nearby. But I think I didn't know him well. I was around him a lot. He played Hilton Head, which I would cover, and he had a lot of success down there. He was difficult to like in a lot of ways early in his career. I mean, he was cocky and brash and had managed to hit the wrong note a lot of times, unintentionally, I think, or maybe unaware. And then, as his life began to change, I think he changed. And I remember he handled what happened at the 1998 U.S. Open at Olympic, where he caught some bad breaks and could have really turned a tough situation, made it worse. He seemed to show a different side of himself, and to listen to the people who knew him tell how he became a different person over time, that's who you sort of listen to and take it from. I think we'd seen some of it, but again, not being terribly close to him, I rely on what the A-Zingers and other people say, that he was a different person and a softer person and sort of, restructured his life and his priorities. And then you think of the joy and the champagne and all that at the country club when they won the Ryder Cup. And, he would have been a Ryder Cup captain, who knows, if maybe now, had what happened not happened. But, he was a guy who had just, you sort of watch Lou Oosthuizen now and you get that swing and that rhythm and that feel that just looks so natural. I mean, Payne Stewart had that. And he could just hit shots. And, he was really good, and he wasn't finished being good until that happened. So, he was a rare one, and that's why there are books about him. I've got Kevin's book sitting right here, and I remember having dinner talking to Kevin about Payne Stewart and all that, and the sense you got that he was a different guy at the end. And I think that's sort of what people remember about him now.
From the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, that's Ron Green Jr. And up next, set to kick off its 26th season next month, Peter DeYoung takes dead aim at his Winter National Junior Series at Pinehurst, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking 5 of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on 5 we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top 5? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.
We're taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors. Peter DeYoung is the patriarch and driving force behind one of the finest high school tournament tours around, the Winter National Junior Series at Pinehurst, set to begin its 26th season next month. Peter, it's that time of year again. It's time for the Winter National Series at Pinehurst. Before we get into the details about what it is and how and where it's being played, I'm always fascinated by this. How long has this series been going on?
Oh, it's we're about to begin our 26th year, and I tell people if I'd known it was going to last this long, I'm not sure I would have ever started the thing. But I absolutely love all the memories and all the kids that have gone through the program. 26 years, Charlie.
Now, has it always been at Pinehurst?
Always. 1994, we began at Pinehurst, and some parents came to me and said, you know, you ought to get involved with these winter series. And I said, I've never even heard of it. And there was only one other in the country. And a gentleman from Michigan went to different resorts in the South, and I went to one of them and watched, and I said, you know what, if I do this, I'm going to have them all at Pinehurst, because what a facility we've got right here in our backyard. And why go around the country when we can come here every week? And that's what we've done.
You know, Peter, I'm glad you brought that up. And we were talking off air. I've been going down to Pinehurst, not just as a golfer myself, but as the dad slash caddy at times of a golfer, whether it be U.S. Kids and now through the Winter National Series at Pinehurst, for a great number of years now. And I've always been blown away by Pinehurst's commitment, ongoing commitment to growing the game and junior golfing. Quite frankly, they don't have to do that as a resort. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of resorts that could care less about that. But it's almost like Pinehurst views itself as sort of a steward of the game in that respect. Talk to me about their involvement with you and how great their commitment with you has been.
I'll tell you what, I couldn't agree more with you, Charlie. The people that are in charge at Pinehurst really care about the game, and they go out of their way for not only the Winter Nationals for 26 years, but as you said, U.S. Kids, they have their own tournaments, the Donald Ross Jr., which is played in around Christmas time.
Right.
Now they have the North and South Jr. that's played in July. They really do go out of their way to cater to the kids that are coming up that will be playing the game. And they understand they'll be the new customers. And that's the way that it's worked at Pinehurst. And I'm telling you that we have introduced probably 2,000 high school golfers to Pinehurst in our history. And you know what U.S. Kids has done, and probably double number. But I'll tell you what, I can't tell you how many kids that I see on the range, they come up to me and say, hey, I played in the Winter Nationals in 96, 97. You probably don't remember me, but boy, well, what a good time we had. And here I am back on vacation with eight other guys, and we're just having a ball. And I love it.
Peter DeYoung is the man behind the Winter National Series at Pinehurst. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. This is not a series for anyone who's not in high school. That's one of the things that makes this kind of unique. You have to be a high school golfer to participate in the Winter Nationals, but you sort of divide it up between freshman and sophomore, junior and senior, which is kind of unique. Why is it that you do that?
Well, when we started this in 94, I had a very little bit of history with junior golf. I worked at Pinehurst back in the 70s, and then I went to Western Golf Association in Chicago, and we ran the Western Junior, but I didn't know enough about junior golf. So my first calls were to college coaches, and I said, give me some background on what we should be doing. And one of the things that always came back to me from many college coaches was, why don't you do this instead of age groups? Play the freshmen and sophomores in one division and the juniors and seniors in another division. That way the freshman sophomore boys won't get overshadowed so much, and they can take home their trophies and they can make a name for themselves. And we did it, and we stayed with it, and we've always done it that way. We didn't have enough girls for a long time, and the divisions were too small in number. So we've lumped all the girls together, and it's better this way. We get probably 15 to 20 girls every weekend, and they play all against each other, and they love it that way.
And so you've got some girls out there that can golf their ball.
Oh, we got a couple girls that played on the LPGA Tour, and many of our girls played college golf or are playing college golf right now.
You know, it's interesting bringing up the grouping of the freshman and sophomore and junior and senior. And when we first got involved, I remember thinking, you know, he's got to play against seniors every week. You know, anyway, why don't they just put them together? But it is interesting, and it is true now that I have this experience of seeing it. There is a jump in maturity level, both physically and especially mentally, between the time someone's 14 and playing the Winter Nationals and the time someone is 18 playing the Winter Nationals. And it's very discernible, Peter.
Very discernible. And I did not know that back when we started this. I just figured, well, they're all in high school. They'll just, isn't that good enough? And you know what? These coaches led me down the right path. And by just what you said, not only physically, but there is a huge physical difference, but mentally on the golf course. And I have parents of some eighth graders and seventh graders that say, you know, we'd love to have our kids play in the Winter Nationals. And my answer to them is wait until he's in high school, or if you really believe, and I'm not talking about his scoring on the golf course, I'm talking about his maturity, I'm talking about can he mentally play against kids that are, you know, 18 years old, and is he really ready for that? And I would wish that a lot of these parents would take a step back and just say, you know what, we're playing this game for fun. This is a game. This isn't a business. This is something that you're going to take with you for the rest of your life. And especially if you come to Pinehurst and play at Pinehurst, you can always tell your friends while you're growing up, hey, I played in a tournament at Pinehurst. This is where the U.S. Open is next year, or the PGA, or the Ryder Cup, you know. And it's a thrill for me to introduce not only the kids but the parents to this resort. So that's why I do it.
You know, Peter, that's great advice, too. Sort of an analogous situation. When we first moved from Alabama to Charlotte, our son's school track was different in Alabama than it was here. And here he would have been eligible to start kindergarten, whereas we had been planning on him not starting kindergarten for a whole other year. And I remember there was a great struggle and consternation. And should we start him early? Should we not? And someone said to me, do you really want him going off to college when he's 17 years old? Were you able to handle going off to college when you were 17? And I said, you know, you're exactly right. Nah, we're going to keep him out. He'll do another year of transitional kindergarten or whatever. And it was one of the best decisions we ever made. Look, you're going to end up there eventually. They're going to be eligible to play the Winter Nationals in a year, and they're going to have 4 years to do it. There's no need to rush.
You are 100% right. And just, you know, let him enjoy growing up, and let him enjoy going out and hitting balls. He's going to be the reason we started the Winter Nationals. And I to this day, I tell the kids, you know, I don't care if you shoot 67, 77, or 87. Wintertime golf is for one thing, stay competitive. If you go out and play with mom and dad in the wintertime, those 3 and 4 footers don't mean too much. But boy, I tell you, you come and play in tournament golf, I don't care if it's December or June or July, those 3 and 4 footers, you know, you're grinding over those. And that's what you got. If you really want to play competitive golf, that's what you're going to have to do. You're going to have to. Every shot makes the difference.
I could not agree more. I'm so glad you brought that up. Peter DeYoung is the man behind the Winter National Junior Series at Pinehurst. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. That's what I have always enjoyed about your series. And you brought up that there's a couple of big tournaments this time of year, or not even yet. I mean, you've got the Tillman coming up the first part of December down at the beach. There's another tournament down at the beach around Thanksgiving. You've got the Ross, which is right around Christmas, New Year's at Pinehurst. But there's not a whole lot of real competitive opportunity. And that's what the Winter National Series, that's really the beauty of it. Not just the competitive opportunity, but the competitive opportunity on some of the finest courses in America. And if you think playing Pinehurst number 2 or Pinehurst number 4 is tough when it's in season, why don't you try playing that when the grass is dormant, Jack?
And it's 40 degrees and the wind's blowing 20 miles an hour out of the north.
Oh,
and you're right. And every kid, we play number 2 twice as a rule. And every one of our members always looks forward. Oh, I've got to play number 2. I can't wait to play number 2. And then it comes to the day and I see him at the scoring table and they went, oh, am I glad that's over. It was the hardest. That's the hardest course in the world. And I said, well, you know, it is 40 degrees and the wind's blowing a little bit. So just remember all your good shots. That's all you want to do.
Yeah, if you just hit one good one on number 2, it'll stay with you.
Oh, golly. And just playing number 2. Are you kidding me? If I was that age and I was 14, 15 years old and I got to play a course that's hosted the U.S. Open,
Wow. That's huge.
It's funny you bring up the kid's attitude about playing number two. I can't wait to play it. I can't wait to play it. I remember David Duvall about 2 years ago talking about the kids on tour saying, man, I wish we could play Tiger. I wish we could get a hold of that Tiger in his prime. And he said, I looked at him and said, the hell you do.
isn't that the truth? Did you see his scorecard yesterday?
I watched him. He hit his first shot in the water. He opened up the tournament by horking a drive left into the water. And I went, oh, God, this is going to be embarrassing. He saves bogey. Then bogey's the next two. And I'm like, how ugly is this going to be? And then all of a sudden I turn around. I'm like, he shot 64? He's got the lead?
He shot 64. How did he do that?
Yeah, they went to 64 in those first three holes. I can promise you that. Peter, let's talk about some of the venues. It utilizes the entire Pinehurst Resort. One of the things we talked about, their commitment to junior golfing. You just mentioned this briefly. They allow the Winter National Series to play on number two. They allow the Winter National Series to play on number four. They allow the Winter National Series to play on number eight. All these great courses at Pinehurst are utilized in this Winter National Series.
That's correct, and we added number nine last year.
Yes,
they bought number nine, which is a Jack Nicklaus signature, and Pinehurst purchased it. I guess 5 years ago, and we negotiated with them, and they said, "Sure, you can play number nine," and we did, and the kids loved it. I had a freshman shoot 69. I think the average score was about 80, but shot 69.
Just for a humble brag, one of the weeks that you went out there, I think it was the first round was at number nine, the second round was at number four, a child named Hogan Nance, who was related to somebody who hosts this show, was the low round at Pinehurst number nine that day.
Fantastic. Well, we're going to do that again, and we're playing all the courses at Pinehurst, which we always do, and playing two twice. We're going to play number four three times this year, and number four is just Gil Hands has done a fantastic job with that, and I'm going to let all the kids play the cradle once this year.
Excellent.
It's not in a tournament round, but I think the cradle is so much fun that I'm going to send them out there with four clubs and tell them, have a ball and keep smiling and keep laughing, because that's what the Winter Nationals should be all about.
Peter, isn't number four amazing? I remember last year when Hogan played in that tournament, and he was walking around, and they, I think they started on the long par three. It's like number five or number six over a chasm. And he played about three holes. And through U.S. kids and whatnot, I had probably caddied on number four for him, I don't know, four or five times over the years. We'd played it a couple of times. He looked at me after three or four holes, and he says, hey, Pop, do you recognize an inch of this? And I said, I'm glad you said that, because I was having trouble envisioning what number four used to look like as opposed to what it looks like now. And it's not that I'm disparaging it. In fact, I think it's a masterpiece. But it's just incredible what Hance was able to do with existing property and have it still be challenging, yet not even resemble what it was before.
He did just an outstanding job with that golf course, and I've started to become somewhat of an aficionado of Gil's work. And I'll tell you what, he is a really, really solid architect. He's done some things, and his do-overs of a lot of golf courses that I didn't even realize that he's done, like Marion up in Philadelphia. He did a do-over there. I think he's got one in Westchester County that he did. I tell you what, he is really good at this.
The website, Mom and Dad, juniorgolfpinehurst.com. Spell out the word junior. Juniorgolfpinehurst.com. That's the website for the Winter National Junior Series at Pinehurst. It all kicks off in the middle of November. Peter, there's still places, because you pay an entry fee. It's like $100 to become a part of the series. And then you can pick and choose which tournaments you want to play. But we still have spaces open, yes?
Yes, we do. And if the website does not answer all your questions, don't hesitate to give us a call, and I'll give you that number also. It's 847-204-9888. That's my cell phone. It'll come directly to me, and if I don't answer it on the first or second ring, I will call you back within an hour.
That's Peter DeYoung. You want some alumni from the Winter National Junior Series? Well, we got Webb Simpson and Jason Duffner and Dustin Johnson. What do those three guys have in common? They're all now major champions. And when we return, we take dead aim with some of the biggest topics in the game with John Patrick, syndicated host of the Augusta Golf Show, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.
We are Taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors. John Patrick and I have been friends for more than 20 years. He played collegiate golf and for more than a decade and a half has been host of the now syndicated Augusta Golf Show, and we had the chance to catch up this week. John, let's begin with what I think is a curious story, because I'm always amused by the quote-unquote transparency of the PGA Tour's drug testing policy, and that's what's happened with Matt Every. For those who don't remember Matt Every or know who he is, he's a classic journeyman professional golfer, won the Arnold Palmer Invitational back-to-back years, got busted in 2010 for marijuana possession, and he's just been suspended by the PGA Tour for marijuana testing positive. But the catch on this is it's actually prescribed by his physician in Florida, yet he's still being suspended under the, you know, performance enhancing drugs. I don't think I've ever heard pot referred to as a PED. What do we make of this? And is the PGA Tour going to be on the wrong side of history here?
Oh, sure they will. Absolutely. They just, everybody's trying to play catch up with all of this, whether it's CBD or legalized marijuana. I mean, the feds haven't done that. So, I think everybody's playing catch-up, and I think the PGA Tour is right there to do that. And, you know, I don't know when all is said and done that, you know, everybody will get all jacked up about Matt Every being suspended. But yeah, they'll be on the wrong side of this.
Isn't that the point, though? It just seems to me that the only suspensions that you get lurid detail about are the Matt Everys of the world, whereas you and I both know Dustin Johnson didn't go away for personal reasons. That was junk. There's other people who've gone away for drug suspensions, and it was completely covered up. I think that's what bothers me about this more than anything else, is the PGA Tour continues to, you know, throw these guys under the bus who no one really cares about, yet there is a level of protection for other players.
Well, yes, but there's a lot like that with the PGA Tour. I can tell you this. I can tell you that in two consecutive weeks on my golf show, I wanted to have a segment that first week talking about, I'm 61, I forget a lot, talking about what the new television schedule might look like, because everybody's going to be up for renewal here after next year, and with the changing dynamic of technology, I wanted to have some people on to talk about, you know, what's possible. Like they want their own network. They may do this. Maybe they'll stream everything. Anyway, I couldn't get anybody to talk about it. No one would come on the show to talk about it, and come to find out it's because the PGA Tour is carefully listening to everybody that talks about what might happen there, and nobody wanted to do it. The tour is like that an awful lot in many cases. It's if somebody really, you know, wanted to sabotage their career and do the big book on the behind the scenes of the PGA Tour, it'd be a pretty good read.
I thought we were going to get it. I really thought Vijay Singh would not settle, and we were going to get stuff out in open court that was going to be mind-blowing. The sum that they must have paid Vijay to not go forward had to be enormous, John, because you and I both know Vijay was pissed.
Yeah, and Vijay is Vijay, and he wasn't going to settle for nothing. So there are a lot of stories like that. There are a lot of backstories with the tour. I mean, it's a dirty little secret that I don't want to say they don't do much, but I mean, every golf tournament that takes place on the back of that 501c3 and that nonprofit, and they're the ones doing all the heavy lifting. The tour shows up and, you know, puts a few signs up and does this sort of thing and takes credit for giving, you know, billions of dollars to charity, when honestly, it is on the backs of all those 501c3s that really do put the legwork in on each and every tournament.
Absolutely. John Patrick is the syndicated host of the Augusta Golf Show. He's our guest, Taking Dead Aim. You briefly mentioned TV. I was fascinated watching the Skins game the other night, or actually I was watching it the next day. I'm not staying up from midnight to 4 a.m. to watch a Skins game in Japan. But there was an interesting player in that we saw a lot of golf TV intermixed on the Golf Channel's coverage. You mentioned the television landscape is going to change. I'm really wondering how much it's going to change and how much of a presence the Golf Channel is going to have going forward, as it seems there's a new player in town.
Well, Golf TV has the rights to the PGA Tour on the European side of the country, rights to everything not domestically. So that was technically a Golf TV coverage that Golf Channel picked up and dealt with. Golf TV, you know, I don't know. It's the player in all of this is the PGA Tour. They would like to somehow figure out a way to have, you know, the NFL Network, to have the NHL Network, to have the MLB Network. They'd like to have the PGA Tour Network. Most people who watch golf think they've got that in the Golf Channel, but they really don't. They really are trying to figure out if there's a way they can make 24 hours of golf on the PGA Network work. I don't know that they will. I don't know. It all depends on what the networks will offer them to cover it. If they don't think they're going to get the money they deserve, they may go down this path. But, like everything else they do, if Fox and if NBC and if CBS pony up enough money, well, not necessarily Fox, if CBS and NBC pony up enough money, then they'll do this again. But they're making a lot of noise about that.
The Skins game was fascinating in another respect to me, in that I didn't realize how much I'd missed it. You and I have been around long enough to remember when the original Skins game was a staple of Thanksgiving television coverage. It was the linchpin of what was known as the silly golf season. Hadn't really seen a good Skins game televised in a good number of years. And as I was watching it, John, what I was thinking about was, this is not going to go away because I'm not even an avid gambler, and I am seeing the potential for gambling on the Skins game as a viewer at home, especially when they were doing some specialty things like having celebrities participate on a hole or the one club on one hole that was a par five. I was just seeing at-home gambling interactive opportunities that I think the PGA Tour is really trying to figure out how to do. What were your thoughts on the Skins game, and am I far off?
You know, you're never far off, but what I kept thinking about was, how much did those four guys get? Was it $8 million? Did they get two apiece? Did they get $10 million? Was it $2.5 apiece?
Because they were playing for chicken feed.
Yep, that's the only way that Skins game happened, was that MGM and or Japan and or Asia ponied up some amount of money. I like $10 million. I like everybody getting $2.5 million. That's the only way that Skins game happened. That's the only way, you know, Tiger is in the Zozo Championship. I'm sure there was another million handed out for that, so he got off the couch for $3.5 million for the week. I'm just speculating on the figure, but trust me, there's an appearance fee in there. So I don't hold out the hope that you do for a Skins game often, partly because it really worked because it was Tiger. It really worked because it was Rory. It really worked because Jason was there, and then Hideki and Asia. You know, I don't know that it's going to work with other players. And even the Skins game that we grew to know and love had its time when it had to go fishing for players, you know, with Fred Funk putting on a skirt.
John Patrick, syndicated host of the Augusta Golf Show, is our guest, Taking Dead Aim. Sticking with Tiger, you mentioned he's in Japan. The game looked rusty for the first few holes of the Skins game. I mean, really rusty, and not just with him, but with everyone. I saw some of the most hideous professional golf shots I've ever seen from inside 170 yards in my life. But as we are speaking right now, the first round of the Zozo Championship was over with. All Tiger Woods did was go out and bogey the the first three holes and then birdie nine of the next 15 to take the first round lead and really, for all intents and purposes, look like the Tiger Woods we know and love. Which leads to the next question, and that is the President's Cup. He's got to finalize his team at the end of this week. A mutual friend of ours, John Feinstein, wrote a really compelling piece this week about why Tiger should not choose Tiger for the President's Cup. What are your thoughts on that, and what do you think he will do?
I don't think he will choose himself. I think Tiger has such, and I did not read John's column, I think Tiger has such respect for the history of the game that this doesn't happen that often. The President's Cup is not the Ryder Cup, and there have been playing captains in the Ryder Cup, but not recently. My gut is he will not choose himself. We'll have to see how the Brooks Koepka thing works out and if Brooks will be back and ready to do this. Dustin Johnson had his knee scoped, and he's kind of back, from what I understand, practicing, and Tiger says he'll be ready. But my gut says he doesn't choose him. Now, can we do another version to where I say he does?
Well, I think you're honest. I mean, I don't think that he chooses himself and leapfrogs Fowler, Finau, and Reed, which is what he would have to do. Now, you bring up Koepka's injury, and if Koepka is unable to perform, I can see Tiger inserting himself as an injury replacement. But I think the initial captain's picks, I'm with you. In fact, I would look to see him just as a point to take Patrick Reed, because he appears to be the only person who can speak with Patrick Reed, and you know, to try to fix what was undone at the Ryder Cup a year ago with that guy.
Well, I also think Tiger wants to be a captain. He wants to be a full bore captain and all that entails. And you can't do that if you're also playing. You'll assign some of those duties to the assistant captains. So, I mean, I think Tiger likes being captain of a team, and I think one day he wants to, and he will be a Ryder Cup captain. I think he's embracing this whole thing, and I think he lets the media swirl around with whether or not he will pick himself. I just don't think he will.
Staying with Tiger just for an extra second. He's announced I guess, as close to a tell-all memoir as we could ever expect from Tiger. Quote, unquote, it's my definitive story. I love the title on a lot of different levels. It's called Back. What do you have any expectation of this at all? I thought the Kataian book was fantastic. I as far as everything I ever wanted to know but didn't, I thought Armin and his partner in writing that book, they wrote the definitive Tiger Woods book. What possibly could he have to offer that we don't know?
Won't offer anything. He will not offer. It'll be a pamphlet. He won't come clean on a whole bunch of stuff. He never has. He never will. It doesn't serve his purpose to do that. He had that image. It was bigger than life. It was, you know, the great golfer. He tore that apart week by week, Waffle House by Waffle House. I think he's going to do all that he can to salvage the legacy. So I do not expect a lot. I do not expect deep insight. I've never gotten deep insight from him. I don't know why he would start now. So I really have low expectations on that. And that's another thing, by the way, to dovetail with my previous story. I tried to get a lot of people to talk about that book on my program. Nobody was going to talk about that book. I had the Golf Channel folks say, yeah, we're going to take a big pass on that. Because nobody likes to poke the Tiger. Even though you never get anything from him, he doesn't do one-on-ones. You don't get these great, insightful long-form interviews with him. Nobody wants to be on his wrong side. So I don't expect a whole lot from the book.
John Patrick's a syndicated host of the Augusta Golf Show, our guest taking Dead Aim. Haven't spoken with you since the whole Koepka McIlroy controversy piped up. Here's my take on it. I don't care what anyone says, as long as they can back it up. It's like the old saying, it ain't bragging if you can back it up. And two, don't we plead for these guys to be candid and to tell us what they're really thinking and really feeling? I think it's kind of bogus for people to come down on Brooks for just giving us what we want.
Well, if you've been around Brooks for any length of time and had conversations with him, that was Brooks. I mean, I don't think he said anything that wasn't factual, and that's just the way he is. I don't think he meant it to be controversial. I just, you know, he's kind of like, here come the words, and it's just, you know, I've been winning for the last few years. He hasn't won since I've been winning. I don't really think it's a rivalry. Tell me where he's wrong. And I think that's how Rory took it. I think, you know, Rory responded as Rory should respond. So, you know, again, the media likes to stir things up. We like to get all worked up about things, but again, be around Brooks for a while and listen to him talk and hear the things he says, and that was classic Brooks Koepka, and I had absolutely no problem with it. I don't think Rory had a problem with it.
Get you out of here on this. October 25th, 1999, a big day. And not a good way in golf history. In recent weeks, you and I have both talked with Kevin Robbins, who has written a spectacular book on Payne Stewart.
Are you actually reading all of these things?
Absolutely.
That's
a fantastic book. You didn't read the Robbins book?
No, I haven't read the Robbins. I have like a job. I
have. Anyway, as you think back now on Payne Stewart, do you think, wow, how great it was? Or are you more in the camp of, wow, we really missed out on what could have been?
Well, we did miss out on what could have been because, as Kevin pointed out, and as anybody who followed Payne at the time, Payne changed in that last year or 18 months. And Kevin tells those stories. You know, there were many times Payne Stewart was not a fun guy to be around, not a nice guy to be around. But however it happened, for whatever reason it happened, and no pun intended, Payne found religion and changed a little bit. So yeah, I'm sorry for what we missed out on because of what he might have been. I think about him all the time on the PGA Tour Champions and what the PGA Tour Champions would be like with Payne out there. So yeah, it's about what we missed out on because of his passing, because of how he had changed and the man that Payne was becoming.
Yeah, I keep thinking about all the things that would have happened. There's no question he would have been perhaps the definitive Ryder Cup captain, maybe twice. I really feel like seeing how great Azinger is on TV, can you imagine how good Payne Stewart would be on TV? And that you talk about a guy who would have the gravitas to comment on anything and everything. It's a three-time major champion. I think he would have been a natural.
Think about if they were together.
Oh!
Yeah. It would be like when we first married Azinger with Faldo. It was great, but put Azinger with Payne on television, it'd be wonderful.
That's John Patrick, syndicated host of the Augusta Golf Show. I'd also like to thank Ron Green Jr. from the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, and from the upcoming Winter National Junior Series at Pinehurst, Peter DeYoung, for their time and insight this week. A reminder, should you just be catching the last little bit of the show, wonder what all we've covered today, no worries. Subscribe to the Taking Dead Aim podcast at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, BePod Studios, Spotify, all the usual podcast outlets, and it will automatically download to the device of your choice. Additionally, a great source of constant golf updates is our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. Featured there now. Links to articles on all the latest goings on in and around the game. Weather-wise, well, fall and the fall rains have arrived in the Carolinas, and it'll be kind of hit and miss this weekend for teeing it up and letting this game continue to haunt your soul and break your heart. But if you do put a peg in the ground, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep it in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter at @CLT_golfguy, and I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. It's going to be a busy year for country superstar Jason Aldean. He's extended his Highway Desperado tour and is teaming up with Kid Rock for Rock the Country tour dates. We've ranked our top 5 Jason Aldean music videos. Text Jason to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Jason to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.